main speaker tonight, I've tried to get some information out of him, but he just said to introduce him as a happy, joyous, sober alcoholic. I'd like to introduce Jimmy S. from Lincolnton, Georgia. Good old boy.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm Jimmy Smith, a very, very happy sober alcoholic. Hello, everybody. Oh, how sweet it is. Yeah. I've had a ball all day watching you people going and coming so happy. I can tell you one thing. This is one of the warmest, friendliest, loving group of people I've ever been around in my life, and I thank you for it. I also want to thank the regular committee now for inviting me here. For many, many years, no one invited me to anything. They told me where to go real regular. So when I get a chance to be invited somewhere, it just thrills me to death. I am from Lincolnton, Georgia. That's 130 miles east of Atlanta. It's rather small. The plane probably had more people on it when I came from Atlanta to Los Angeles than my whole town's got. Our largest industry is the 300-pound Avon lady. And when she comes calling, you better answer, too. Boy, y'all alive. I love it. Yeah. I'm a former school teacher and football coach. And now I'm president of a bakery and vice president of cook and dishwasher and delivery boy. In other words, I bake cakes in my kitchen and I peddle them out on the street. I used to lie a lot. I still do when I can get away with it. I used to say I made my living that way, and that's a lie. My wife makes a living. A lot of people ask me why she didn't come with me, and I told them, simple, she got to make a living, you know. But I do love and I do appreciate it very much. AA to me is the most marvelous, wonderful thing that ever was created or ever was given to anybody on the face of the earth. I get so excited thinking about it and looking at all you people out here. I just feel like I'm going to bust sometimes. People always asking me on my cake ride, Jimmy, how are you today? And I just have to tell them honestly, if I got the butter, I believe I just float away most of my days. I haven't always been this way. I used to have an ego problem. I said used to. You know what an ego problem is? Right before the great San Francisco earthquake in 1906, a drunk passed out. After it was all over with, he raised up and he looked around at all of that destruction and he said, Lord, how will I ever pay for all of this? I haven't had that problem too much lately. If there's a judge in here, peace, please. But a lot of judges I've known in my time, and I happen to have known a few on the wrong side, kind of felt like real ego trips. It kind of felt like God went on vacation and left them in charge. And this one particular one was bad. I mean, he was the baddest of the bad. I hope y'all can understand this. Y'all got a bad accent, but I hope you can understand my normal talking, you know. But poor old fella sitting on the front row here, the judge just gave him all he could give him. And he raved that so proud of his pompous self. And a fly got to buzz around his head, just going zoo, 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 zoo around his head. And he was trying to slap at it and kill it. And he got the bailiff up there to help him. And they tried to identify the fly and they tried to kill it. And they didn't know what it was. They got the sheriff up there. And he was slapping and knocking at the fly. And they were all trying to kill it. And nobody knew what kind of fly it was. Little fella raised his hand and said, I know what it is, Your Honor. He says, you do. What is it? He said, it's a zuzu fly. He said, I never heard tell of a zuzu fly. I said, what kind of fly is that? He said, oh, you know, Your Honor, the kind of the old rings be buzzing around horses' asses. He said, are you trying to say that's what I am? He said, oh, no, sir, Your Honor, but you don't do them zuzu flies. We're doing half of AA right now to me, and that's laughter. If y'all hadn't laughed when I came, I wouldn't be here now. I didn't have sense enough to know what else was going on, but you laugh. You stand outside any AA meeting you want to anywhere, and you hear people laughing. You hear people having a good time. I came to AA simply because I was brought. Didn't have anywhere else to go either. But always you made me feel better when I came. You would hug me and you'd kiss me and you'd say, Jimmy, we love you. And boy, hadn't anybody told me that for years and years and years. And when I leave, you would hug me and say, come back. Nobody certainly hadn't invited me back. So it was just a joy to come and go, you know, and I always felt better when I left. I didn't know what you were doing, and I'll explain why in a little bit. But I always did feel better when you came back, you know, invited me back. And, you know, it's so marvelous. I can never pay that back, the kindness, the sympathy, the love that people showed me. And I'd come back out of jail again, my head down and my tail tucked like an old hound dog. And they'd meet me at the door and lift my head up, and they'd kiss me and hug me and say, Jimmy, we love you. Please keep coming back. And that's just a marvelous feeling. And my sponsor is a smart aleck, always has been, always will be, I'm sure. And he told me one night, he said, Jimmy, please keep coming back. He said, we need you so bad. He said, I got you now, buddy. There ain't nothing you need me for. He said, oh, yes, it is. So we tell the new people to watch you. If they don't quit drinking, they're going to end up just like you. I went home bragging to my wife. I was so proud of that. Just so proud of it. You talking about sick, honey. You better believe it. That's why I can stand here barefooted, just barefaced, looking square in the eye and guarantee it works. No ifs, no ands, no maybes, no exceptions. And the word been changed in how it works in 50 years. Not one soul in this room is too dumb for the program. And sure as hell ain't none of you too smart for the program. A lot of you think you are. None of you are unique. You're not special. You're not different. You're an alcoholic. And the program was made perfect for us. When my wife first started reading the big book she had, she said, how in the world did they know you so well 50 years ago? But it's all down for us. That's what makes it so marvelous. But you know, another great thing, and I might as well tell you now, I've got 11 years, 4 months, and 5 days sobriety. Thank you. Every single day gets better. Every day gets better. After I'd been sober 3 or 4 years, I told my wife, I said, it can't get any better than this. But I lied. The 5th year was better. The 6th year was better. The 8th year was better. The 9th year was better. And I know now tomorrow will be better. I almost envy newcomers, because you can't imagine what a marvelous journey is going on. You just can't imagine what a fantastic trip it is to get sober and to grow every day and to see all the miracles happen around you every day. It's just the most wonderful thing I know of. Now, this is the love part that's coming, and some of y'all may know more about this than I do, but I don't know. I've got a lot of brain damage, and I can't keep up with time, but 18 or 20 years ago, well, I might as well tell you this first. I was in and out of AA for 10 years before I got sober. So if anybody's struggling, don't quit. It took me 10 full years of hard coming to AA, and I got a friend in my group that took her 14, and a friend in South Georgia took him 16. But we're among the 3 or 4 happiest people I know. I was in and out of AA like a yo-yo. I picked up enough white chips to build a nice patio. But the marvelous thing about it, no one ever said anything but, Jimmy, come back, we love you. But somewhere along in all of this, some 18, 20 years ago, in my home group of Thompson, Georgia, we had a man come from Los Angeles to speak. He had moved to the Atlanta area, and he told the story of being a member of the original 8 people that started AA in Los Angeles sometime in the late 30s. And the way he told it, they did kind of like a lot of us do. They worked the first step, and they jumped all the way down to number 12. They'd been in the business about 2 weeks. They went to the courthouse, and they talked to a judge and explained to him what they wanted to do. Apparently, he was a wise judge, and he said, I got just the man for you. And there I sat out on the front row, shaking, sick. He couldn't walk. He was just shaking all over, and he couldn't do anything but totter about. He looked like death warmed over. And the judge said, I was going to put him on the chain gang, but I'm going to give him to you 8 people for 30 days, and then you bring him back to me, and I'll decide what to do. 8 people got on 3-hour shifts. At least one of them were with him at all times. Most of the time, the whole group was with him. And for 30 days, they fed him real well, and they exercised him, and they carried him to meetings, and they did everything you should do for someone. And they carried him to the Salvation Army, and they got him some clothes. So at the end of 30 days, you know, he'd improved a lot. He could stand up straight and he could walk around. He had just a slight color in his cheeks. His eyes had cleared up, and they bought him a suit. And they set him on the front row, and all eight of them right behind him, so proud. The judge looked down and says, "Who is he?" And the bailiff said, "Well, I don't know, but I'll find out." And the bailiff went out and talked to the man. He said, "Well, I'm the man that the judge gave to these people 30 days ago. The judge said, "This is marvelous." Eight people ran back so proud. He said, "It's just wonderful." They got more proud, you know. Sitting there, he said, "One man kept eight people sober for 30 days. Some of y'all know him, I imagine. That's the love of AA. Get involved in it. You always hear, and everywhere you go, get in the middle of it. Get in the middle of it. That way you're not going to fall out. If we were out on a big raft in the ocean, we wouldn't be hanging on the edge over here because some shark or something might reach over and grab us. We'd get over in the middle of the raft. Do the same thing with AA. Jump right over in the middle of it with both feet and get happy with it. You know, dry and sober are so different. When I was trying to coach and teach, I'd be dry 8 or 9 months at a time, absolutely miserable. Most drunks I know got similar symptoms. We have a hole in our belly, stomach, excuse me. The wind blows through and butterflies flying in and out. We're full of fear and guilt and shame and remorse and all kind of anxieties. We drink. At first, it helps. We start feeling like you're looking. Our insides are looking at your outsides, and we begin to feel a little better. But somewhere along the line, and in my case, very quickly, it quit helping me, and it started doing to me. And that's when the trouble starts. And people say, "All you got to do is just don't drink." If you don't drink, you're dry. You still got the hole in your stomach, and the wind's blowing through it, and you're full of fear and guilt and shame and remorse. All your anxieties, "I never fit anywhere." When I was coaching, I said, "Man, we win this big championship game Friday night, and I'll be happy." And we'd win it, and I'd say, "Is that all there is?" I'd feel let down. I'd see this gorgeous lady, and I have to say, y'all got an auditorium full of gorgeous ladies. And I'd say, "If I can just get a date with her, my world will be great." And I'd get the date, and I'd have that let down feeling. That's because I was dry all of that time. That is the most miserable feeling on the world. If all you people did to me was get me dry, I'd shoot every one of you. I want to be sober. What is sober? Dictionary says to be calm and normal and rational. I like other words better, like happy, joyous, and free. A whole lot of peace and serenity. That's what sobriety is. Where you get sobriety? Right where you're sitting. Right where you're sitting in AA meetings. If you don't drink today, you go to meetings today and you live these 12 steps today the best you can, I guarantee you with all my heart and soul, you will get sober. You will get happy. And if you don't have it and you got a little bit of time in, you're cheating yourself. Because I'm not different and I'm not special, and I see other people that are happy as I am. But you got to do something. You can't sit there and say like I used to, "Here I am, God, do your thing." It don't work that way. You got to get up and get at it and do something to get your sobriety part in there. And if you don't, you're cheating yourself. I've seen some people been around the program several years, and I'm not taking their inventory. But I have a right to read what they advertise. But you come in a meeting, they're sitting there with a long face. And they griping and bitching and moaning about every time. I say, "Isn't it a wonderful day today?" "I don't see what's so good about it." And I say, "Well, are you happy?" "Yeah, I'm happy." And I want to run up and shake them and say, "If you're happy, tear your face about it. Let it show." Let everybody know you're happy. People ought to be able to see us go into the supermarket or a drugstore and see something different. Something special. Any newcomer can look in the eyes of people in the group. Don't you see that little glint? You know, that little something like a cat that ate the canary, or "I know a secret, but I ain't gonna tell." You know, kind of that idea of the thing. That's the whole kid in Kabul to me. Get involved, go to work, and get sober. I used to, before I got to you people, I woke up in the strangest places. I wake up in a strange jail. That's one you're not in real often, you know, it's a strange jail. And I wouldn't know why I was there. I wouldn't know if I killed someone in a car wreck, if I'd robbed a store. And I think it's Friday, and it might be the Monday of next week. Lost 10 or 12 days there in a blackout. That's a horrible, frightening feeling. Excuse me. I woke up in hospitals a lot of times. My arms and legs spread out, strapped down, and band crossing my belly, and used that mess all over myself, screaming for somebody to do something for me. And I woke up in the woods an awful lot. And I'll tell you how I got there in a little bit. But I woke up in the woods a lot, and again, I'd messed all over myself. And I have ants and spiders crawling all in my clothes, just an awful fix. I don't do that anymore. I don't have to do that anymore. And I have you people to thank you for it. Because, see, we can do what I couldn't do. To me, that's the most marvelous quote in the world. And Atlanta Men's Workshop prize on that too. We can do what I couldn't do. We, all you people in the program itself, my God can, you can keep me sober. I couldn't keep myself sober any way under the sun, and I tried every way in the world, because I did not want to be a drunk. Did anybody in here want to be one? No. Nobody in here grew up telling everybody, I want to grow up and be a drunk and go to jail and hospital and prison and all that. I happen to think I was born an alcoholic, and I started drinking and off and running, and that was it for me. But I did not want to be one. I became a Christian in the Baptist church when I was 14 years old, and they put enough guilt on me for 80 people. And my disease got worse, and I'm not knocking anything now, but I tried not to be an alcoholic. I turned over new leaves, and I showed character, and I showed guts, and I got everything together not to drink. But I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. I've been to tent meetings where they place hands on you and shake and shout to get the demons out. And I've been to tent meetings where they chant round and round speaking in tongues to get the demons out. And I'm at the many psychiatrists. And I had 29 shock treatments. You talking about a mess. You take a brain like mine was and burn it 29 times, you got an awful mess. I mean, an awful mess. And then I clinched it off by going to a witch doctor. I didn't know that until about 3 years ago. Fell in Augusta, Georgia, right across the river from North Augusta, where I met my good friend George here. I was going to tell it like it should have been until I met somebody from home. So I got to tell it like it is now, you know. But I was riding, they were riding me around, babysitting me, and I kept wanting to see a witch doctor. So they killed me. And said they came to this rich doctor and he sprinkled powder and stuff all over me and wrapped me up like a mummy and dumped me on my mother's back porch. And like scared her to death, but that didn't work either. Only thing that ever works when I got to you people. Oh, that's the most wonderful, joyous part of it all when I got to you people and you taught me sobriety. Because, see, in Lincoln County, my little town where I am, and trying to coach and teach in a little county like that, and by the way, it was dry all the time I was drinking. And after I'd been sober about 3 years, they got together and voted it wet, just for me. But I'd have to go across the river into Carolina, 4 miles across the river there, to a liquor store. And I tell myself the same second lie many times. You all know the first lie. You wake up at 12 and you're supposed to be in to work at 8. Or you wake up in a ditch or jail or hungover and you say, oh God, I'll never take another drink as long as I live. And you mean that. I would have said that a long time ago and kind of let it slide, you know. And I tell myself that second big lie as I head across the river, I'm not going to mess up this time because I'm going to buy a half a pint. Can't get drunk on a half a pint. I'd go across the river and buy a half a pint. I'd take a drink coming back to the river. And I'd turn around and go back to the liquor store and buy all my money would buy. And I'd be off and running and drunk again. Didn't go to bars, juke joints, anywhere and drink. I was ashamed of it. And trying to coach and teach and do the right things, you know, I was trying not to drink. And I'd go home and get into bed and drink. Now my wife come used to Augusta and back. And she'd come home the third, fourth, or fifth day, however long she could stand it. And she'd call the law. And the law lives about far as near, or the jail's about far as near to the front door out yonder from my house. And they would all come over to my house, both of them. That's all we had then was two. They would not have a warrant. They'd pick me up out of the bed and take me to jail. I could not make a phone call. If I happened to have money, I could not pay my way out of jail. And I used to think they kept me until they got ready to turn me loose. A year or two ago, I learned that they kept me until my wife got ready for them to turn me loose. he would take the boys to the beach in the summer, and she'd call the sheriff before she left and say, if you see him out of the house while I'm gone, lock him up and keep him till I get back. They were quite well about doing that, too. But see, I was the only man in jail most of the time. And at 5 o'clock now noon, they all locked up and went home. There wasn't nobody there but me and the booger bass till 8 o'clock the next morning. And that wasn't too pleasant. And I wasn't learning anything. So I started going to jail in Augusta and Greenville, Spartanburg, around, you know. And they put you in a drunk tank. Don't forget, we alcoholics are brilliant people. And I'm kind of up on the top racket of the brilliant set. So I started going to these other jails, and they'd throw you in a drunk tank with 20 or 30 other people. And after 2 or 3 days, I could talk a little bit, and we kind of shoot the bull, you know. And they said, well, they can't do you that way. I said, what do you mean they can't do me that way? He said, you have rights. I said, well, tell me about it. So I made me a list of my rights, and I carried them to the sheriff, and I said, you violate one more, and I'm going to sue you. Don't forget, I'm intelligent. And he said, okay, from then on my wife would have to pay $2 to get out of warrant, and I'd have to pay $70 to get out of jail. Now, that's intelligent. And I went all over town bragging that I showed him, and yeah, you showed him all. I'm a little bit slow in some things, even with my business. And after that happened about 75 times, I learned don't go home drinking. So I would go hide on a little sawmill road somewhere on the lake there at home, and I would drink 2.5, 3 weeks. Wouldn't eat a bite of food, just drink. And that's how I would end up in the woods. I'd get out and wander in the briar patches and the bushes and usually end up messing on myself and getting sick. And they found us quite a few times, all broken up. Just real sick, right on the verge of death. And they came into the hospitals in Augusta and they tell my family's going to die. He's got gastro this and intestinal that and liver this. And then I wouldn't die. And they say, well, he'll be a vegetable. He'll just lie here forever. And they'd have a tube everywhere you can put a tube. And then I wouldn't die. I wouldn't be a vegetable. And they say he's a wet brain. He's drank so much that he doesn't know right from wrong. He's drank so much that he can't comprehend what's going on in life. So you might as well put him in an institution and let him go on about his business. Or you go on about your business. When my wife first started carrying me to AA back in 1970, she would tell him, the doctor says he can't stay sober. He hadn't got sense enough, and they'd pat her and smile and hug her. So you just keep bringing him back. I can never forget those people that showed such kindness and such love and such compassion. And that's why they took me to these two great psychiatrists in Augusta. Some of you might be familiar with the movie and the book, Three Faces of Eve. Well, she was their patient. And they talked to me for quite a while, and they told my wife that, oh, he's not bad. Said he's paranoid, schizophrenic, manic, depressive, and 10 or 12 other words about that long. It says, we're going to cure him with the electroconvulsive therapy. And that's where that came about. But as you can see, as I told you to start with a while ago, that didn't do any good from that standpoint at all. During my dry periods, I would accumulate a few things. My wife would get a little bit of faith in me after 7 or 8 months, you know. So up until then, I'd have enough money for cigarettes, and that was about it. Because she didn't trust me too much with money. But she'd make a mistake, slip up and say, give me a $20 bill. Say, Jimmy, go get us a loaf of bread. And I'd get back 2.5, 3 weeks later. Used to make me so mad when I got back. She said, where have you been? And if I'd have known, I'd been glad to tell her. Those were some unbelievable days. And I'm not supposed to be an alcoholic. I think that's very obvious. I'm too good looking. I'm too charming. I'm too intelligent to be a drunk. But yet here I stand. My father was an alcoholic. He was a country doctor, and I swore I'd never ever be like my daddy, and I've heard that statement thousands of times. And I wasn't like him. I was much worse than he ever thought about being. He was killed when I was 19, and I'd hated him every day of my life because of that. And I swore I would never ever take a drink. And in high school, I made all A's in school, was captain of the football team, president of every club in school, and voted most likely to succeed. Oh, how wrong they were. On the outside, I looked pretty good. On the inside was where the mess was. But I went to the University of Georgia, never going to drink anything. And my buddy said, come on, Jimmy, drink a beer. It won't hurt you. And I listened and listened for 2 or 3 months. And God is my witness, I plan to drink a beer. I never drank anything in my life. From that day on, I drank everything I could get my hands on. I got drunk that night. I had a blackout that night. And I woke up the next morning, my whole world had changed. Up until then, I'd wanted to be a doctor. But I realized then I couldn't go to school 12 years. I could not study and go to all these hard classes. So I ended up taking a lot of ping pong, badminton, and horseshoes and such, you know. And I could drink and go to classes, and I could stay out all night and party and carry on. Should have known then what it was, because right off the bat I was in trouble with alcohol, and I had to hustle and scramble after my daddy was killed to try to get enough money for beer and all. I did without food in college where I could drink. Athens was dry at the time except for beer and wine. I'd go to a bootleg and buy shine liquor, a half a gallon of it on Sunday night, pour it up in half pints and carry it to class with me. Should have known what it was, but nobody could have told me anything. I was in ROTC and got the little gold bar that says you're an officer and a gentleman. And I go to Fort Benning. Things were different now. I had a paycheck coming in, officers' clubs down there, and women around them like flies. Beer was 10 cents and whiskey was 10 cents. I said, Lord, I have died and gone to heaven, you know. But it didn't last long. I'm 22 years old and my disease is progressing in a hurry. In a few months' time, I'd be out there on the floor dancing with these beautiful girls, thinking I'm Fred Astaire or Michael Jackson or somebody stomping all over the feet. I'd take them over to sit them down and turn them over in the chair. I just might lie down across the table and pass out in front of everybody. I did it several times. You don't do that much before they get tired of fooling with you. So they got where they didn't want to go out with me, and I didn't want to go. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed of myself. So I would stay in my room and drink every night. I was bachelor also. I got Saturday mornings off the whole reveille at 5 o'clock every morning. I'd go with that feeling like 400 hells. I found out if you go on sick call, they give you the same medicine. I don't care what was wrong with you. They give you a bottle of G.I. Gin. And I see some eyes rolling. That's carbon hydrate and codeine cough syrup. It had about 65% alcohol and a whole lot of codeine, and I could drink a bottle of that and walk this high all morning. I'd come in at night and start on my beer and liquor again. I don't know how I got out of the service without getting court martialed, but I got out and I'm 25 years old and now I'm going to coach. I'm not stupid, and I know you can't coach people, children, and drink liquor. So I got my first job in Savannah, Georgia, down on the coast, and I was driving down thinking, now do it, just don't drink. I'd been drinking every day for 8 years, but just quit, you know, just stop. And I did all morning. And I was just so proud of myself. And I got out there and signed the papers. They said, Coach, that we're having a party for all the coaches in the area tonight. I want you to be sure and come. And I got out there and they had big old wash pots boiling to cook shrimp in. And they had oysters ice down over here in tubs. And they had beer ice down. And they had whiskey ice down. They said, Coach Smith, would you have a beer? I said, yes, thank you. I'll have one. I got knee walking drunk. Turned a pot of boiling water over on the athletic director's feet. Scalded them, and everybody down there knew that Coach Smith was a drunk. But they didn't really care. They were so short of teachers. We were in a double session school. We started at 7:20 every morning, got out at 12 o'clock, and I'd go to school smelling it like a liquor bottle. And the person put his arm around me and said, "Woo, Coach, you smell it like a keg of liquor." He said, "Do you drink all night or do you drink when you get up?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Yeah, I believe you do." They didn't fire me, but they didn't rehire me either. In the meantime, my lovely wife and I, now my wife, we've been dating 9 years. She's pretty good at an on then, because she thought all she needed to do was marry me and she straightened me out. But that didn't work. Anyhow, she had a good job in Augusta, so I got a job in Augusta. This old principal there, now I knew wasn't going to be the same story with him. There'll be no drinking around this fella. And that's when I started making myself be dry. And I'd go there 8 or 9 months at a time, and I'd just be so dry I couldn't stand it. And people would be telling me how well I'm doing. You're just looking great, son. You're doing so good. They couldn't see my insides. They couldn't see the knots in my belly. And they couldn't see me lie down at night, my mind running 9,000 miles an hour. And they couldn't feel all the feelings I was having. And they're telling me I'm doing good. I couldn't stand it. That's when I started telling myself that second big lie. But I'm not going to mess up this time. And I'd only got drunk about twice a year. And I managed to stay there 2 years. Then I came to Lincoln. Lincoln is my hometown, and we're well known for our football team in Georgia. We're a small school, but we win an awful lot of state championships. And people said, now, Jimmy, you're home. Said, get back in your church and get involved. And I taught Sunday school, and I taught training union, and I did all the other things I tried to tell you to stay sober. And I'd make it 8 or 9 months, and I just couldn't stand it. And I'd go across that river and buy half a pint, and I'd be in trouble again. I was not head coach. I was defensive coordinator. We won state in 60, and the state run-ups in 61, won the state in 62 and 63. And my little school was going to coach the all-star team in Atlanta. And I was so proud. This was in the last of July. And they said, Jimmy, if you don't drink this summer. I mean, you can't tell this drunk not to drink during the summer. And I went across the river and bought a half a pint. And I went back and got more, and I got drunk, and I had a red, cut my face all up, and I had to resign. And for 2 years, I didn't drink much alcohol, because I drank alcohol on the ground, the floor, and the bushes. But I drank a awful lot of cough syrup. I had the alcohol and the codeine and Nimbitol I found from others, and I could kind of walk and function a little bit on that. So at the end of 2 years, they thought I'd been straight, so I got a chance to take the same job back. And when I went back, I was drinking 4 or 6 ounces of that cough syrup, along with my liquor. 4 years after that, in 1970, I was drinking about a quart and a half a day. I'm 6 foot tall. At the time, I weighed 122 or 3 pounds. I looked like I'd been dead a week. My eyes way back in my head and hanging on down. And I've had false teeth since I was real young. My mouth got me in trouble early. And I'd have my teeth in my pocket and be in a strange jail. And I've been drunk maybe 2 or 3 weeks and hadn't bathed or shaved. And if I could throw your mess all over myself, and I'd be lying on the floor in the jail, and everybody come back, kick you, and spit on you, and pee on you. And finally, I could get up on my feet a little bit and try to start surviving. Can anybody imagine how low and how full of humiliation and shame you get for yourself and self-disgust that you get for yourself when you're going through all of that? So in 1970, I had to resign again. And I told myself, my wife, I said, sugar, it can't get any worse than this. But we have a progressive disease that only gets worse and worse and worse. And see, I am an alcoholic. Not a beer-holic, wine-holic, gin-holic. I've been drunk weeks at a time on lemon extract. Many weeks at a time on Minnie's aftershave, all the other extracts, hair tonic, mouthwash, perfume. That's my wife ever got at me. Some company gave her a little bottle of perfume that cost $100, and I drank it one night. But the worst thing about it, for the next 3 or 4 days, both ends were just awful. And 2 years ago, another company gave her another bottle of it, and she put it on, and we both got sick. So she just had to give the stuff away. Somebody sitting in the room left saying, I never drank all that stuff. I promised you in the beginning that if you live and you keep coming there, you get sober. I'm going to promise you something else. If you live and you keep drinking, you'll do everything I've done. During my dry periods, I'd accumulate a little bit, and I'd go across the river to the liquor store and beg the man to swap a $75 rod and reel for a $5 quart of liquor. $30 and $40 knives for a half pint or whatever. Went to a bootlegger once, begging him to let me have a half pint of shine on credit. Wasn't my 50 cents. But I didn't have 50 cents. And I kept begging him. He said, I like your shoes. I said, oh, come on, man. Let me have it on credit. He said, I like your shoes. I walked off in my sock feet for a half pint of shine liquor. I once swapped my boat, motor, and trailer for a case of beer. Please don't say you won't do it. Please don't. I've heard people say it. I've been locked up in many places, and people say they wouldn't do such, but they will. And our disease progresses and progresses. In 1970, when I had to resign the second time, I'd already been in jail 35 or 40 times. I've been in hospitals 35 or 40 times. I had 7 DUIs piled up. And I told my wife, I said, sugar, it can't get any worse than this. But it gets worse and worse and worse. English teacher, I know it's no such word as worse. But you go back out and drink, you say it got a hell of a lot worse. Always does. Nothing describes it quite like that. From 7 to the June 1st, 79, which is my sobriety date, I went back to jail another 190 to 200 times. I went back to hospitals 90 to 100 times. I went to prison one time. I went to 2 Christian homes for alcoholics, stayed in one of them a year. The judge sent me through a 28-day treatment program in South Georgia for a whole year. He said, if anybody needs it, you do. I've had hallucinations, convulsions, and DTs. I've been beat up by cops in jail and been beat up by inmates in jail. All after I said it can't get any worse. But listen to me, you don't have to go where I did to be an alcoholic. There's a little girl in my neighbor group, 15, been sober 2 years. I got a lot of friends, 16 and 18, with 1 and 2 years sobriety. You can get off the elevator any way you want to. If you just want to bad enough, and you come to enough meetings, and you follow the old timers, and you follow people that's got it, and you listen to them. The three most dangerous words I ever hear is, I've been thinking. My thinking kept me drunk for 20-some years. They told me to listen to my sponsors in the reading book, do what they said, and quit thinking. And that helped more than anything I know of when I started listening to those people and quit thinking for myself. But in 1970, when I had resigned from coaching, you know, you can lose your driver's license here in Bakersfield. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But you lose your driver's license in a little bitty town like mine. I try to sneak out of town and somebody called the sheriff and said, Jimmy's driving, why can't I? So they'd be waiting on me coming back across the river again, you know, and then I would have had it. Took me a long time to learn that somebody was telling somebody something, you know. For a while I could convince somebody I used to coach or ever played ball with, but I was going to die if they didn't take and get me a drink. And for a little few months they would do it. Then they got what they said, no, Jimmy, I'll take you to a doctor, I'll buy you some food, but I won't give you a dime. I started begging on the streets of my little hometown where I'd been a football coach, kind of a hero. I'd beg on the streets for a quarter or a dime or anything they would give me. And I'd go in stores and beg people that I went to school with and I grew up with. I had no pride, I had no dignity, I had no self-respect. I had one consuming thought, my next something. Something that I had to get in me. And I'd go in the stores and steal the extracts and the men's aftershave and all right off the shelf, hoping they wouldn't tell me. Wouldn't tell on me, wouldn't turn me in. I don't think my life could ever have gotten much lower than what it was then, but that was the beginning of some hellacious years. I had to start Abel's. Went in the store and said, Miles Nervine, if you take 2 teaspoons every 4 hours, it'll calm you down. I'm a good drunk. I drank a bottle every 3 or 4 hours. And boy, did it calm me down. Not like this podium up here. My wife came home and I was out cold and she couldn't find the liquor or anything and she asked all around town, they told her what I'd been dying. And she called Dr. Pennington, he's straight. And he got a bottle of it, says the bromide. And I've since learned that that was one of the early detox methods, was the bromide type thing. And it leaves your body very slowly. And I had almost killed myself. And the doctor described it as rust on my cells. This was in 17. We was waiting on the Georgia Regional Hospital in Augusta to open. For 5 days, my wife hand-fed me. For the next 3 days, I could get up and go to the table and eat. But I'd hurry back to bed because I'd had the most beautiful dreams anybody ever had. I heard the sweetest music, saw the prettiest lights. I went on the other side of Mars and looked at all of it. The 8 days were up, they got me in the hospital and explained it was going to take months to get all this out of my system. So they kept me for 6 months. It was good. I put on some weight. They had a good meal program and gym facilities. And I worked out and I ate properly and I got up back to about 150 pounds and I had a chance for a job and my wife was going to take me back. And the second step, it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And I was always saying, I'm brilliant when I'm sober. I'm just crazy when I'm drunk. And I think most of us are that way, but I beg to disagree with you. They tell me I went back to the regional 34 more times. I ended up going to all the treatment centers in the area, and I started going to Linwood, which is a VA hospital in Augusta. And I would get drunk or get in a fight on the alcohol ward, and they put me in 15 East, which is the nut ward. And me and other nuts would be there together for a few weeks. That's not very pleasant living. But finally it all boiled down. Milledgeville, the state hospital for the insane in Georgia. The drunks of a hopeless, helpless, incurable, brain-damaged drunks. They would take 60 or 70 of us and put us on the same floor with 60 or 70 crazy people. had little army bunks in the room, and I could rub the elbow on this wall and touch the other wall with this hand. And I stayed in my room an awful lot. Because you get out in the hall with these other people and they'd have a bowel movement and run down the leg, pick it up and throw it at you. They'd sit down at the table, eat with one hand and masturbate with the other hand. And they'd sneak up behind you and try to bite you. And they were always spitting on you when you walked by. So I stayed in my room an awful lot. I had a little window. And I was always up on the third floor. Big old trees with limbs coming right up to the windows. And birds would come right on the limbs, and I'd sit and talk to the birds and tell them I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not ever going to drink again as long as I live. And I promise God, and I promise my wife and my children and everybody I ever knew, but I'm not ever going to drink again. I'm not an animal, and I'm not a criminal, and I'll not sit up here behind bars and be treated like one. But if I ever get out, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to do all the things I'm supposed to do. And I'm going to be a good father and a good husband and a good citizen. And after a few months, they would let me come home on a trial basis. And I'd be home 2 days or 4 days or 6 days. And I'd tell myself that same second lie. As I start across the river, I'm not going to mess up this time. And I'd be back after I was detoxed, sitting in the same chair, looking out the same window, talking to the same birds, saying, I'm not going to mess up this time. I'm not ever going to drink again as long as I live. And I could see cars running up and down the highway out there and pulling boats and motors behind them. And I'm going fishing with my children. And I'm going to take them picnicking like these people are doing. And I'm going to ride. And I'm going to do all the things I'm supposed to do. People, you do that, let that happen to you once, much less 40, 50, 80 times. When you get out of a place like that and your life's looking pretty good, and you're free, and you're thinking about how happy you are, and then you think about taking one little drink. That's the insanity of alcoholism. Thinking that it's going to be different this time. It is going to be different. It's going to be worse than it was last time. It took me almost forever to learn that the first drink's what got me drunk. Please believe me that you don't have to go where I did. We don't see ourselves as other people see us. When I was in college with a boy, he used to get so drunk. I was embarrassed about it. I was ashamed of it. He'd lay his head on the table and he'd slip a saucer under his mouth, fill it up with beer, and he'd just slip it up. I always said, if I get as bad as Frank, I'll quit. I ran up on Frank in the poker about 7, 8 years ago. He said, you know, Jimmy, when I used to be in college with you, I'd watch you. I always said, if I get bad as Jimmy, I'm going to quit. We just don't see ourselves like other people see us. But please believe me, you don't have to go where I did in order to get sober. Something wonderful did happen in 1970, though. This dear sweet nurse scared my wife and I to our first AA meeting. It was a closed meeting in Augusta, Georgia, at the Hill Group. Johnny knows Sam down there and all those wonderful people. I went over here and my wife went over here and we came out and got in the car. I said, sugar, what did they tell you? She said, they told me I'd been wrong, but I shouldn't pour out your liquor. And I fell in love with AA instantly, right there. I really thought I was going to carry her to as many meetings as I could get her to. And I went because of what I told you to start with. You made me welcome. And you hugged me. And you told me you loved me. And you told me to come back. And you told me to keep coming, Jimmy, to get better. My mind was so bad and damaged so bad I couldn't comprehend or understand. And I'd hear speakers been in jail twice, the hospital twice or something. I really couldn't relate. I really couldn't understand. All I knew is I felt better when I went to y'all. But I would end up drunk again. Back in jail again, hospital again. And when I'd get out, like I told you to start with my tail tucked and head down, you'd pick me back up again and you'd love me and kiss me. Somebody kept telling me, Jim, if you keep going, you'll get it one day. In 1975, this is 5 years later, I was out at the regional again. They were having a state convention in Augusta. And this dear friend of mine came and got me out of the hospital and carried me to the convention. I went primarily to get out of the hospital. And they were going to have a meal and they were going to have a dance afterward. I didn't think it was going to really do me any good. I thought I was hopeless. Cold tears going all over me now. The man got up and said, my name is Jack Brennan. And he said, I wasn't supposed to be able to come tonight. I said, God's got one man he wants me to talk to. said to over 1,000, please be quiet and let him listen. And cold chills just go all over me, knowing that God loved me that much to send him all the way from Brooklyn to talk to me. And I hope the other 1,000 people thought the same thing. But he was 12 and his little brother was 10 and daddy was drunk and they were hiding. The little brother found a jug of wine and he tasted it and he said, oh, Jack, you're sweet. He said, it's so good, Jack, you taste it. And Jack tasted it but said it wasn't sweet. He said it wasn't sour. He said it was absolute magic. The most wonderful thing he ever put in his mouth. He woke up in his mother's arms and she was crying and saying, Jack, I can't stand two of you. He said, Mama, Mama, what do you mean? She said, you drank the whole jug and you passed out this Sunday morning and I can't stand you and your daddy both being drunk. He said, Mama, don't cry. Please don't cry. I won't ever do it again. Planning where he would get his next drink. Instant alcoholic. He grew up and things kept getting worse. He got married and things got worse. He was a wheelman for the mafia and he lost his job because of alcohol. His wife threatened to burn down every saloon in the neighborhood if they sold him a drink. She said, Jack, there's something new in New York. Something called Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, if you go with me, I'll buy you a drink. And you know how that is, you're falling him out of the hill for a drink. So he went to the meeting. He said, all he remembered them saying is, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. He said, anybody knows that. Things got worse for Jack, and his wife got the court papers to have him thrown out of the house. And two cops came to serve him, and he whipped them. And they came back with eight, and they broke both jaws and all his fingers, and he woke up in a straitjacket in the hospital. And he's kind of like me, and some of the rest of you, when he got out, he went looking for them, and he happened to find all eight of them together. And they broke both jaws and all his fingers, and he woke up in a straitjacket in the hospital. And as he put it, so would you believe I found him 12 more times? And this man was getting my attention. I was listening to him. And then they threw him out of Brooklyn. As I understand it, the only man to this day ever thrown out of Brooklyn. But he went on the Bowery on Skid Row. He'd been down there 3 years. And don't forget, he'd never been but to one meeting. And he was in a dying condition. He was in the back of a filthy restroom with his chin hooked on a commode trying to get a drink to stay down. And the drink kept coming back, and the blood kept coming back, and the bowel kept coming back. One meeting's all he'd ever been to, and the voice said, Jack, you had enough. Call AA. That was my God that was talking to him, and he said, I had it in the palm of my hand and turned it loose. He crawled out on the sidewalk. It took him hours to get out there. He was so weak. And when he got out there, he looked so horrible, smelled so bad, and had bugs all over him. People were afraid of him. And finally, someone said, yes, we'll call. And he said, a little man, a little woman came with all the love in the world and said, come on, go with us, and you may never drink again. That night in Augusta, it was 28 years ago, that night. Jack died in June, 48 years of sobriety. He's not God, he's a messenger. He got my attention. He made me believe that even I could get sober. And God works through all you wonderful people. And he sent these people from Thompson to the same meeting. And they invited me to their group. Thompson's also a little town. And I'd go to the meetings, but the doctors wasn't wrong. I had an awful lot of brain damage. And I couldn't find the meetings quite 2 nights on the road to save my neck. And I'd ride and ride and ride, and I couldn't find where I was going. I put off the road and sit and cry. Because I couldn't find where I was going. Sometimes I'd get there just as the meetings were over. But all you ever said to them is, Jimmy, we love you. Please keep coming back. Sometimes I could get there in the middle of the meeting. But you always told me the same thing. And sometimes I'd get there a little bit early, but I couldn't stay. I was so distraught and so shook up and so nervous that I'd leave in 5 or 10 minutes. But you told me the same thing. Come back, Jimmy, we love you. My first sponsor couldn't read or write a word. He died for 26 years of sobriety, one of the wisest men I've ever known. And he told me one day, he said, Jimmy, quit trying to stay sober. And that like scared me to death. I said, Dawson, please don't give up on me. He said, oh, no. But I want you to let go and let God. You can't do it, and he can. And he said, remember this. He said, if you're sober, they can't lock you up anywhere. They won't put you in jail. They won't put you in a hospital. Every hour I was spent in jail seemed like a month to me. And he said he won't lock you up. He won't do anything to you. And lo and behold, June 1st, 1980, I had a birthday. I get too tickled thinking about it because they didn't think I'd ever live to have one. And they were so happy for me. I got where I could find a meeting sometimes 3 nights in a row. But the same thing, they kept telling me, we love you, Jimmy. Somewhere between the second and third year, I don't know, time gets away from me an awful lot. Someone asked me to speak. Things got beginning to get a little bit better. You know, when you're drunk and a cop's got you, he's kicking you and cussing you and throwing you around. And when I first started going to speak, I didn't know where anything was, you know, in the meetings. But you pull up in front of a cop like I'm dressed now and say, officer, can you tell me where such and such church is? He said, well, yes, sir, I sure can, sir. And that just tickled the hell out of me. You tickled me to death. After I learned well all the places where I'd still stop a cop master. My wife would be with me. She said, oh, don't bother a cop. You know where you're going? I said, yeah, I want to hear him. No, I enjoy it. See, having brain damage has a lot of privileges. And I enjoy all of them very much. Very much. You can come in an AA meeting and hug and kiss all the pretty ladies. I walk right back out the door and wait 2 or 3 minutes, come back and pretend I just got there and hug and kiss them all again. I did it 4 times one night. Found a new girl, said to an older lady, said, this is the 4th time he's been in here. She said, just leave him alone. He's got brain damage. Any of you ladies, I have a hug a minimum of 8 times. Please see me before you leave. Lincoln and his little 2 blocks. I live 2 blocks from that. Jail's like to throw you between me and town. I can ride up town, come home about 1.5 minutes, and I do it a lot. I used to do it a little bit more, and I'd ride up and come back, ride up and come back, ride up and come back many times. A young man in his yard one day when out there working, and I'd ride by him and ride right back by him. I saw him that night. He said, Coach said, you passed me at least 30 times today. And came right back by him and said, where was you going? I said, nowhere. He said, well, what were you doing? I said, nothing. He said, well, why were you doing it? And I grinned at him and said, cause I can. He looked at me and said, I can too, but I didn't. He said, he's supposed to be sober. I do a lot of things simply because I can. For so many years, I was locked up, drunk, scared, in a mess. I do a lot of little things just simply because I can, and I enjoy it a whole lot. My life gets better every day. I used to tell him about, you know, and looking out at people riding up and down the road with the children and all, and I do that now. I didn't see my 2 sons grow up. They're 30 and 25. We've had a wall between us for years. But I've told my sponsorees, and I've been told all my life, if I don't drink today, if I go to meetings today and I live these 12 steps to my best of my ability, and I let go and let God do it, the little work, they kept telling me to stay away, to leave it alone, to leave it alone. And in June, my oldest son was in the hospital, manic depression. In my opinion, I think he's an alcoholic. He just doesn't drink. I told my wife many times, I wish I could just get him drunk 2 or 3 times and bring him in the program and he'd get happy. But he was manic depressive, and he'd been there about 4 days, and he called and wanted to talk to me. And I called all my sponsors. I got about 8. I said, y'all say a little prayer for me and help me in this situation. I got down there. We got the wall broken down. He didn't even want to hear the word A mentioned in the house. But now we got the wall broken down, and I was able to put my arms around him and hug him and tell him that I love him. And he's done the same thing to me. That's what you people gave me. I got a little grandson 2 months old. I can talk the next 4 days about him. And I'm going to get to see him grow up. I'm a good grandfather, too. I'm being a former coach. My son's didn't care anything about any sport, but my grandson loves all balls. And he nicknamed me himself, Ball Daddy. So, you know how proud that made me. If anyone in this room has a doubt, but AA works, I got all night. We'll sit and talk about it. If you have any doubt that it's the greatest thing that ever was on the face of the earth, I got from now to next year to sit and talk to you about it. Because nothing on this earth is like AA to me. Knowing that there's 86,000 places I can walk in the door and say, hi, I'm Jimmy, and I'm welcome. I see our little bumper stickers easy go, easy does it one day at a time, and I get that warm glow all over me, and I just start feeling good. And all the time I've known I'm going to come out here and see you people, it's just been a marvelous thrill to me. Hey, people are so warm and so loving and caring, and everywhere I go, these outside people say, y'all have more fun than anybody I've ever seen in my life. And you know, most of them are crazy as a bat, but you don't know why. That's the fortunate thing about it. We're crazy and we know why, and we know what to do about it. If you're struggling with AA, please keep struggling, because it's worth it. I don't care how long it takes you to get sober, it's worth it. Keep coming back, and I guarantee you, you will get sober. I love you all with all my heart and soul. If you're ever around anywhere in Georgia, please call me. Thank you so much.